Okay, so we'll get started now. Apologies for the usual Camtasia-related delays. So if you recall from last week, we were discussing simulation models. The purpose of these models is to offer an alternative to either mathematical analysis or prototyping of systems in the design process of systems. Okay, and design is sort of used to cover a multitude of sins, both in terms of starting out from scratch and building a system, and also studying existing systems and how existing systems might be changed or might need to accommodate a changing environment. Okay. And simulation offers a quite flexible tool. It's more flexible in general than mathematical analysis. A sort of less restrictive set of assumptions needs to be made about the form of your system in order to get interesting results. It can also offer a less expensive alternative to prototyping. So potentially building a system can be quite expensive, or taking a system offline to do testing on it can be quite expensive. So this is a way of answering sort of what-if questions without having to actually build something. Okay. So in general, a simulation model is anything which produces some mathematical representation of system behavior. Okay, we're looking at a very specific type of representation where the core of this representation is an event, where an event is a distinct point in time where the system state changes. Okay, so you're going along and everything's sort of normal, and then something happens and your system's in a whole different state. The example we used was a queue. You know, things are running along, and every so often, a new job arrives. So that's a significant change to the system. Every so often, a job completes its service, and again, this is a significant change to the system. These events have time related to them as well. They don't just occur completely randomly, but instead we choose a fixed time for each of these events to occur. Okay. When I say fixed, in actuality, these times tend to be non-deterministic. They tend to have a probabilistic description, but when we do our model, we actually pick one out of a number of possibilities. Okay. So the behavioral representation we get from a system then is this sequence of events with times of occurrence attached to them. Okay. And we want to extract some information from these sequences. Typically this information has to do with in some way with time parameters. Okay, so examining when events occur or the duration of, not events, but of processes within the system will give you some information about the performance of the system. So in terms of networks, what might we be interested in? Well, we might be interested in queue length, so how many packets are building up at a switch, for instance. That will translate into delay at that switch, so how long are the packets having to wait at a switch. Sort of generically in a network, you can talk about end-to-end delay, loss. Typically, a lot of loss occurs because there is delay, so if the delay gets to be big enough, then the packets are dropped. Jitter, so if a sequence of packets is transitioning through the network, then the inter-arrival times of those packets will sort of stretch and contract due to sort of different delays experienced throughout the network. And overall in the network, quantities like throughput, how many packets can we push through, efficiency, sort of how well are we using the capacity of the network. Okay. So, again, all of these can be somehow extracted by, if you've built your model right anyway, can be extracted by examining the timestamps on the events, examining the time between occurrences of different types of events. Okay. Now, the issue with that we're going to address today is that when you run your simulation, you get one possible behavior out of, in general, an infinite number. So how can we look at one possible behavior and then generalize to what the system does in general? Well, the answer is we probably can't, but we will be able to look at a fixed number, a selection of possible behaviors, and from this selection of behaviors, infer something about a sort of overall system behavior. In general, that will be couched in terms of averages. So we'll talk about an average delay, an average loss, average waiting times. Okay. So that's where we're going to go today. Just to wrap up with what we did last week we examined sort of what are the major components of your simulation model. Again, if you're using NS or OpNet or something, but if you're sitting down to write a simulation model yourself, well, what are the sort of big things that you actually have to implement? Okay, and the core of our simulation model, again, is the future event list. So a list of the events that will occur in the future of your system. Okay, so as you're going along, obviously this list changes according to what events occur as time passes. And so we also need an event scheduler to encompass or to determine what happens when events occur. Okay, so you examine your future event list, you pick out the nearest event, the nearest event that should occur next. You examine that event, and based on that, you might decide, well, in the future, other things are going to occur. Like if you have an arrival event, well, in the future, a departure event will occur. And also, again, sometimes an event will cause another event to not occur in the future. Okay. If your house is on fire, the arrival of the fire brigade will hopefully remove the event that the house burns down completely. Something like that. Okay. So the final thing that we have to account for is time. And so any event is going to be associated with a clock. And the time of events then, again, is going to be random according to some distribution. So the final thing we examined last time was how did we generate random samples? So how did we generate sequences of random events that had the characteristics of specific distributions? Okay. And so there's two steps to that in general. First, we looked at the uniform distribution. So there's a uniform it's equally likely that the event will occur or that the variable takes on any value in an interval. And we looked at possible ways of generating sequences of numbers that had this distribution. Okay. And so intuitively what you'd think is if you generate a big sequence of numbers, then if you plotted them out, or you'd see roughly the same amount, you'd see roughly the same amount occurring at any point in the plot. Okay. So now the final topic there is producing these sequences which have different distributions, so non-uniform distributions. We deferred that discussion to this lecture, so that's where we'll take up with how do you take, in general, our uniform distribution, transform the sequences of numbers we get through this uniform distribution into something that looks like variables or variates with some other distribution. Okay, so hopefully we're still recording. Now, again, we stopped at having looked at, I shouldn't say a number of ways to generate uniformly distributed random variables, but at least one way, and then mentions that in general there's a lot of software packages out there that will help you with generating uniform random variables anyway. Okay. So now what we're going to do is use our uniform variates to produce variates of other distributions. Okay, and there's one very simple technique that's commonly used, which is called the inverse transform technique. And anytime you have a cumulative distribution function which is invertible, then it's quite easy to change from a uniform distribution to some other distribution. So we'll go over how that technique works, and then we'll look at a number of common distributions that you might be interested in using, and we'll see how these common distributions are generated. Again, you should note that some of these distributions at least can also be, you can use Java to generate some of these distributions as well. So depending what you need, you may get lucky and you may be able to avoid having to write any software to actually do it. But we'll have a look at the techniques that you can use anyway. They're fairly straightforward. Okay. So, we have our uniformly distributed random variates. The distribution, interval over which they're distributed is 0 to 1. Okay. Now, suppose we have some probability distribution with a cumulative density function, f of x, capital F of x, and so that's just the probability that our variable falls in the region less than x. Then the inverse transform technique is quite simple. We take our uniformly distributed variable r, and we let x be the inverse cumulative density function of r. Okay. So again, as a technique, that's quite straightforward. Now, to have a look at why that works, the easiest thing to do is pretty much proof by picture. So if X is F inverse of R, then conversely, R is F of X. And so the probability that we're in this region less than X is the same as the probability that our variable R would be in the region less than R. Okay. So, again, what we've done is we picked some R, we then found our X, and we want to relate the two probabilities. So, what we want is the probability that we're in this region less than X, but again, we can go back and examine our uniform random variable, and we see that what we've done is we've fixed our R to be less than F of X. Okay. So the probability that our random variable R is less than F of X is the same as the probability that our random variable X is less than this fixed point X, which is F inverse of R. Okay. Now, the trick is then, at least in terms of the proof, that you note that the probability that R is less than, that our random variable R is less than our fixed value R equals F of X, because it's uniform, the probability of that is F of X. The probability that R is less than any value, a half is a half, etc. Okay. So, that gives us that we've generated our CDF so that R is less than F of X, and that gives us the CDF that we want for X as well. Okay. So, again, it's relatively easy to convince yourself that that works. And in terms of implementation then, the only thing you need to do is be able to invert our cumulative distribution function. Okay. Then, what do we do? We've got our sequences of R's, so we've got R's, the R1, R2, R3 that are uniformly distributed. We can make that into a sequence X1, X2, X3, which are distributed according to some other function, just by, again, taking the inverse CDF of R. Okay. So, if we look at a concrete example, we'll take the exponential distribution, and you can see I was being a bit economical with my diagrams, same curve essentially. I just now have put in a very specific CDF. Okay. We know what the CDF of the exponential distribution is. It's 1 minus e to the minus lambda x. And so by our transform technique, what we want to do is take x is the inverse transform of r, or the in- inverse transform of F applied to R. Okay. So we can start by setting R equal to the CDF, and again, just solving for X. That's what the inverse transform is, right? Okay, so R in this case is 1 minus e to the lambda x. And so we just massage it till we get x out. So we isolate e to the minus lambda x and get 1 minus r on the other side then. We then take the natural log of that to extract out minus lambda x. And so once you've done that, well, you've almost got x, all you have to do is divide by minus lambda. Okay. So again, in terms of implementation now, all you have to do is sort of take your original sequence of variates and plug it into this equation, and you'll get the sequence of variates that you want. Okay, I threw in one last step here, and this is just a little trick which is used frequently, so just so you've seen it. We replace 1 minus r by r, and that works because 1 minus r is also uniformly distributed between 0 and 1. Obviously, yeah, if you picked one value that was bigger, you'd get a value that's smaller, but since it's a uniform distribution, there's an exact correspondence between the two. Okay, so that's a straightforward example. We'll look at one more example where we do exactly this. We take the inverse of the CDF to come up with our distribution, to generate our variates. In some cases, you can't do this directly. So in some cases, it might be actually difficult to invert the probability distribution function. So we'll look at a few of those cases, and again, look at tricks that can be used to actually generate the variates in these cases where sort of brute force inversion is difficult. Okay, so a second example is a uniformly distributed function, but now over a range A, B, rather than the range 0 to 1. Okay. So the technique is the same. We generate the CDF, and obviously there's a typo there. That should be a capital F, not the small f, just to distinguish it from the PDF. Okay. So in order to generate uniform random variates over this other range, we again take the inverse of our CDF. So we set R equal to the CDF and solve for X. Okay. And so again, you can convince yourself that that's the correct method. Okay, so I had a lapse in memory here and have included the exponential distribution again. So no real new information on this slide. Okay, so now we come to a distribution where it's not quite so easy to generate our random variate. and this is the Erlang distribution, and this is a not uncommon type of distribution to encounter. It's a distribution which is a composite of a number of simpler random variables with specific distributions. So in the case of the Erlang distribution, what you have is the sum of a number of random variables, and each of these random variables has the exponential distribution. So one thing this could represent potentially is the time it takes to do a series of jobs. You know, again, frequently we assume that service time for jobs is exponential, and so how long does it take to do a number of these jobs would then be represented by the Erlang distribution. Okay. And so it's not terribly easy to you can write down what the CDF for the Erlang is, but it's not terribly easy to invert it. But in terms of implementation, well, you can just note that this distribution was produced as a sum of these exponential random variables. We know how to produce exponential random variates, so the easiest thing to do is just do the obvious and take a sum of k exponentially distributed random variates. Okay, so you're adding one additional step to the inverse transform technique, and that is this summing step. Okay, so first you generate k exponentially distributed random variates, then you sum them. Okay. So the normal one is another one that's notoriously complicated in terms of even defining CDFs for a normal distribution is non-trivial. Again, what we'll see is usually anything related to CDFs and the normal distribution is represented in tabular form. So you start calculating out values for specific numbers. Okay, so, and again, it's not, you can't just go and invert directly. Okay. So what we need to do is somehow, without inverting directly, get a relationship between our uniformly distributed random variables and the normal distribution. This relationship is going to come about through the use of the central limit theorem. Okay, and I have a slightly bigger discussion of this in the next set of slides. I again only intended to mention it in this lecture as in terms of implementation and technique. We'll have a look at sort of some look at the progression of variables to the central to the normal distributions in the next lecture. But roughly what the central limit theorem says is that if you take a sum of identically distributed independent random variables with, and since they're identically distributed, they all have the same mean and the same variance. And so we sum these, then the sum of these approaches a normal distribution with a mean of k mu and a variance of k sigma squared. Okay, and so you have to take sort of enough of these values, but if you sum enough of them up, then the distribution begins looking normal. And I'll show you a few pictures of that when we get to the next section of the lecture. Okay. So what we can do is say that the variables that we want to sum up are our uniformly distributed random variates. Okay. And so if we sum up enough of these uniformly distributed random variates, then the distribution we're going to get looks normal. Okay. So we have two normal distributions, and we've pegged them both to normal 0, 1 just for comparison purposes. Okay. So we have the x, which is distributed normal with a mean of mu and a variance of sigma squared, and we want that to be related to this sum of random variates. And so what we're going to have to do is essentially adjust the compare them along according to normal 0, 1. Okay. So we'll adjust our sum Ri according to its mean and its variance, and compare the two. Okay. So what do we have? We can calculate for a uniform distribution that our mean is 1/2 and our variance is 1/12. Okay. This means that if we're summing up a number of them, a number k of them, then the sum is going to start looking normal with a mean of k times 1/2, and the variance is going to start looking normal with at k times 1/12, so k times the original variance. Okay. So that means that we can adjust the sum. So if we subtract off the mean that centers it around 0, if we divide by the square root of the variance, then that, or the square root of, square root of the variance, then that adjusts the variance to be 1. Okay. So we take our sum, and this is the sum of the uniformly distributed random variates. We subtract off the mean, we divide by the square root of our variance, and that's also distributed normal 0, 1. Okay. So now we have two random variables that are distributed normal 0, 1. One is x, the one we want, and one is in terms of our uniformly distributed random variates. So in order to get x, what do we do? Well, we just have to set the two of them equal. So both these random variables have the same distribution, so we can set them equal to each other. And obviously it then becomes not a difficult task to solve for X. And so in this way we get and random variable that's a function of our, or random variate that's a function of our uniform random variates, so k of these uniform random variates, and distributed at least approximately normal with the correct mean and the correct variance. Okay. IID is independent, so the two variables have nothing to do with each other in the sense that if you know one, you don't know anything about the other one. You can't predict any more with any more certainty what value of the other one is going to be. And identically distributed. So each of them has the same probability distribution. Okay, and again, those are two terms, the independent and the identically distributed, that we will be encountering again and again throughout this lecture because, well, again, primarily because the central limit theorem depends on them. And so then we'll be examining how likely it is that we actually do get independence. Identical distributions are more likely. So identically distributed means, well, exactly what it says, that if you have x1, x2, x3, and each one of those has a probability distribution. And identical means that they have the same probability distribution. So in this case, what we have specifically is R1, R2, R3, up to Rk. All of them are distributed uniform between 0 and 1. So they're all picked out of the same type of sample. Okay, so the last distribution that I'll mention is the Poisson distribution, and the interpretation of a Poisson process is that if we examine a fixed period in time, then the Poisson process models the number of occurrences of an event in that period of time. Okay. And so it gives you a discrete density function now, or which again gives you the probability that one event, zero events occurs, one event occurs, two events occur, and that Pn is e to the minus lambda times lambda n over n factorial. Okay. So, again, our standard theory doesn't really describe how to deal with this, but we can appeal to a property of Poisson distributions, which is that the time between successive occurrences of events for Poisson distributions is exponentially distributed with a mean of 1 over lambda. So we know how to generate exponential variates. And so hopefully we can use that to generate our Poisson variates. Okay. So what we have is some time period. We'll assume that that time period is one, from 0 to 1. And what Poisson says is that, well, we'll have some number of occurrences of the event, so we want to know what the probability of that number being n is. And each of the times between events is exponentially distributed. Okay. And again, with this, with the mean 1 over lambda. So what we do is we let our time be between events be represented by our exponentially distributed random variance. So okay. And what's the quantity that's of interest to us? Well, the quantity of interest to us is how many of these random variates does it take to just get past time 1. Okay. Because that's our Poisson variant. Okay. So all we need to do is generate a sequence of exponentially distributed random variates. Then we start summing them. We keep a running count of how many we're summing up. And whenever our value exceeds 1, that's our number n. Okay. So this number n, this count of how many of these random variates we needed to exceed 1, is our variance that's distributed according to the Poisson distribution. Okay, and so again, when Connor discusses queuing models with you, you'll undoubtedly look at this interplay between exponential and Poisson distributions sort of in greater detail. But for our purposes, what we have is just a trick to generate the variate if we need it. Okay, so that wraps up the introduction to simulation lecture. Again, the primary sort of takeaway points are what's the purpose of simulation, and then again, what are the major components needed to implement simulation models. Okay, and so what you get is more or less a toolkit. Then you have to look at your specific problem, and we'll be posting the first assignment early next week. So there what you'll get is a very specific problem that you need to model, and you'll have a crack at sort of again producing all of these components for this very specific model. Okay. So what we're going to move on to now is more mathematical. It's a look at what we can say about various components of our no idea what that was about. Okay, so what we can look at, what we can say about various components of our model and sort of how statistically sound they are. Okay. Now, we're going to spend the bulk of this lecture examining output. Obviously, this is a critical portion of your simulation model. You need, when you've made this, you've got this sample behavior, and now you need to decide, well, what's the likelihood that this sample behavior is representative of generic system behavior? Because potentially you can, if you look at a single run, you could just get unlucky, get a really pathological case, and this would not actually tell you anything about, in general, how the system is going to behave. So we'll look at how you produce results that are statistically significant. At the very end, I will just mention looking at input as well. I had contemplated sort of having a discussion of sort of input analysis as well, and looking at a few of the tests like chi-squared, but I decided that we really didn't have time to do it properly. So I'll mention it. It's from, important in terms of the exercises, we're going to tell you what the input is, so it's not necessary to worry about. Keep at the back of your mind that, in general, when you're doing this sort of analysis, input is very important. Frequently, when you have input, you'll be looking at sort of real-life scenarios. You'll gather data from observing the input behavior. If you're in a network, what are the use patterns for that network? Obviously, what you need to do then is take the data that you've observed and somehow fit it to mathematical distributions, fit it to sort of mathematical representations of this data so that you can use that in your simulation. Okay, and there's a whole art to that as well. It's not something that gets any treatment really in Harry Peros, which is another reason I decided to, again, give it short shrift myself. If you're curious, the Banks book has a quite nice discussion of this portion of the problem. Okay, so again, the core of this talk is going to be output analysis, and we're going to look again at one, probably the most important result in terms of output analysis, which is the generation of confidence intervals. Okay. So, again, why do you analyze your output? Well, because you want to know something about the system, and that can be in terms of predicting performance for the system, for a single system, or comparing two or more alternative systems. Okay. So, when we run our simulation model, again, what we're getting is one possible system behavior out of an infinite number of system behaviors. And what we would like to do from this observation is to perform some sort of statistical analysis and estimate system parameters. So again, those parameters are things like the average waiting time, the average queue length, And again, also looking at sort of one statistic on the standard deviation. Okay. So when we produce our results, that's one sample of a random variable. In actuality, one sample is not going to help us a lot. What we're going to need is a number of these samples, and then we're going to examine how a number of these samples can bring us close to the true system parameters, as opposed to our estimated parameters, and how close those two can get. Okay. Percentiles refers to essentially binning up your results. So a percentile says that 95% of your results fall below a certain value, or 80%, or et cetera. Okay. And we won't actually address them. The way we examine percentiles is essentially a special case of the mean and standard of the estimation of mean and standard deviation. Again, Peres doesn't mention it. If you're interested, Banks has a discussion of it. Okay. So, again, in our system, we have two types of variables, which are sort of internal to the system, called exogenous, because they're called that because they aren't affected by the actual state of the system. And if we think of our example of a queue, these are the inter-arrival times and the service times. So these are things that we generate, not things that we observe. And endogenous are the opposite of that. They're variables that we observe rather than generate. Okay, and again, if we look at the queuing example, this could be the waiting time in the queue, the number of jobs in the queue, etc. Okay, so it's these endogenous variables that we are going to examine and try to draw conclusions about. Okay, so there's a discussion in Peres of how do you collect these variables, and to be honest, the easiest way to do it is to export all of your information to a file for sort of processing at a later date. Okay, so if you have a simulation, then again, we said the output of the simulation is an event trace, so a sequence of events and timestamps. And if you save that somewhere, you can examine it at a later date and sort of process it after the fact. Again, Peres discusses how you might hold the sort of relevant data within the program itself. And so he suggests that you can use linked lists. So just every time sort of you get a new value, you add a node to the lists. Or potentially you can have, you can just keep a running count of whatever value you're interested in. Okay. So as an example, we have waiting time. If we want to look at waiting times, an arrival event is paired with a departure event. Okay, and obviously the waiting time is the time between arrivals and departures. Okay, so what you could do, again, is form a linked list which has the pair, the arrival, the departure, and then the duration obviously is the time between the departure and the time between the arrival and the departure. Potentially, you could be lazier than that if you could just keep a running tally of time between arrivals and departures. So just sort of as an increment, you can increment it every time there's a departure. And also, you'd probably need to keep track of how many arrivals and departures there had been. Okay. But, like I say, a lot of times it's actually much simpler to just dump the data into a file somewhere. Then you have it, if you choose to do different, if you choose to try and extract, you can extract different sorts of information from it by sort of later processing. If you hard code it in, then you're limited to what you thought of at the time. Okay, so just to look at that a little more concretely, suppose we're given a queue. And so we would need to know the distribution of the arrival and service processes. And so the arrival times, the inter-arrival times would be picked according to some distribution. And the inter-departure times would also be picked according to some distribution. Okay, so I've said that this is going to be first in, first out, so take each sort of job in the order it arrives, just because that makes the picture a little easier. In actuality, it doesn't really matter. In terms of you, for any sort of normal service distribution, you can sort of extract the same sort of data fairly easily. Okay, so what happens when we model this? We start out with some initial condition, and we run the simulation for a fixed period of time t, and obviously in that time t, there will be a fixed number of arrivals. Okay, so what we get from that is a single sample trace of behavior from the system. Okay, and so I've given an example of that sample trace here. And so we have our arrivals happening at random times and our departures also happening at random times. Okay, so what sort of data might we want to extract from that sort of system? And we've mentioned the two biggies, the average waiting time and the average queue length. Okay. So the average waiting time is pretty straightforward. You just look at the waiting, you add N arrivals, you look at the waiting time for each of those, and you average over that, so you divide by n. You sum them all up and divide by n. Okay, so that's a very simple average. Now, there's a few details about that, sort of the most obvious of which is that it's possible in your system, not in this case, not the way I drew it, but it's possible in your system that if you end your simulation at a fixed time, that there may still be jobs in the system, so arrivals in the system that have not received, have not received service. Okay, so obviously, you don't have a waiting time for those jobs. So either there's two ways to deal with that. You can either make their waiting time, the termination time minus their arrival time, or when you're taking your average, you can only consider those jobs that have actually received service. Okay. Now, obviously, if you're taking a small number of, if you take just a small number of jobs, so N is a pretty small number, then either of those could possibly present problems for the average. What you hope is, or what you would aim for, is to use an N which is big enough that, well, there's only a small number of jobs that haven't received service at the end of your simulation, and this number is far outweighed by the ones that have, so however you choose to deal with them, they don't actually affect the value that you calculate a whole pile. Okay. Now, the average queue length is a bit more complicated. The queue length varies as a function of time, and so the average is a time average now. The first average was an average over event occurrences. This is a time average. And so you have to integrate over all points in time and then divide by the period of your simulation. Okay. So on the face of this, this is not a straightforward piece of data to gather. How do we do this integration? But what we would want to observe is that our value for N changes only upon either an arrival or a departure. So you have large blocks of time where the value of N is constant. Okay. So if we look at sort of the beginning, first we have an arrival, and then at a point later a departure occurred. So what information do we have? Well, in that time period, we know that N was 1. We also know the duration of that time period. Okay, it's the difference between the arrival and the departure events. Okay. So instead of doing an integral, what we can do is track the various what value N has at any given time, and any time an event occurs, we can track the amount of time that N spent at a particular level and add that to our total. Okay. So what I'm saying there is that you can sort of add, you can do that integration as sort of block areas of squares and keep them as running totals, potentially in an array where you'd have an entry for any value of N, and then again just keep a track of how much time is spent with N at any given level. Okay. So that's again more implementation. Just how do you sort of extract it's a few examples of how you extract the information you want from the data you're given. Now, moving on to the core of the lecture, we want to observe that, so we've got these two numbers, W and N. These numbers, in terms of the overall system, these numbers are random variates. They're not fixed. They have a statistical distribution, obviously quite complicated based on what the actual system is. Okay. So, if we take one observation point, one value of W, one value of N, then it's not clear exactly how that value relates to sort of the overall system distribution. Okay. What we're going to try and do is take a number of observations of W or N. So we'll have to, well, the simplest way to think of it for the moment is just think of running your simulation a number of times with different seeds for your random number generator. So you'll get different observations each time. That'll give you a number of values for these. We can look at the average value and the variance on that value. And what we'll want to do is see how close our observed average values come to the actual system value. So this is going to be sort of the core result of the of what we do today. Okay. Yeah. So I will mention one final note, which is again regarding the observation of a single trace of behavior, and that is that in general in the system our behavior breaks itself up into two portions. An initial phase, which we call the transient phase, and this initial phase is dependent on the initial conditions that you provide for the system. Okay. And then a steady state phase, during which the statistical behavior of the system is no longer dependent on the initial conditions. So for our purposes, what this means is that our means and our variances now will cycle around a fixed point, a fixed value. Okay. So if we look, for instance, at the average Q length, then what we see, well, we probably start the simulation with Q empty. And so no matter how fast things are arriving and how fast they're being served, it'll take a while for that queue to build up. Okay. In general, if you know the service time and if you know the service distribution and the arrival distribution, you can say in general what the average queue length is going to be, sort of given enough time. So there's going to come a point where the queue builds up to sort of a representative behavior for this system. And for this representative behavior, then we would expect certain properties even of a single sample. Again, if we observe even a single sample, we would expect the values not to always be the average Q length, obviously, but to be somehow cycling around this average Q length. And again, if we take the time average over a long period of time, we would expect it to be equal to the system average, so the actual average Q length for this sort of system. Okay. So the results that we're going to examine refer to this steady state portion of our system behavior. Okay. The transient portion can be of interest. In some cases, you don't have a steady state, so all you can simulate is the transient portion. In other cases, you might examine this transient portion to, for instance, examine how initial conditions impact on system behavior. So you actually do want to look at how systems react to very specific conditions. So in that case, you'd look at this transient phase. But what we're going to look at is this steady state phase. Okay, and in the steady state phase, and again, averages in the system are fixed, and your time averages should equal your statistical averages. Okay. So, implementation-wise, this raises the question that how do you know you're in steady state? Because obviously the data that we think is, that we're interested in is the steady state data. The transient data is only going to sort of skew our results. At worst, if you take a very short run, then all you're going to get is sort of, your statistics are going to be based primarily on this transient data. And therefore aren't going to be representative of the steady state at all. So, in some way, we need to determine when we've gone from transients to steady state, and that's not sort of at a fixed point necessarily, but we can try and determine it by taking runs of different lengths and then look at sort of and choose a run length so that your statistics aren't varying significantly if you vary the run length any further. Okay. And so what that's doing essentially is saying that we've picked, you know, we've taken enough samples that this transient state is only a small portion of our sample, small number of our samples, and its impact on the overall values in the system is negligible. Okay, so the second way we can deal with transient data is to, again, fix some time t where we've decided that we are out of the transient phase and start collecting the data only after t. Possibly this will lead to a shorter run because we aren't having to sort of compensate for the values that we collected during the transient phase. We just don't collect those values. Okay, so I'll take a break now for 15 or 20 minutes, and when we return, again, we will look at steady state estimators. So how can we estimate certain system parameters, and then what can we say about how good our estimates are?